You're listening to KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond, grassroots listener-supported, solar-powered radio broadcasting live from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa. And this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my mother and co-host, Caroline Kilborn.
And good afternoon, everyone. I wouldn't mind seeing some solar today.
It's true. We've got an overcast day. We had a beautiful day yesterday.
Oh, my gosh.
For a January day in Iowa, and it's getting colder as we speak. The temperature is dropping. And I think our guest today knows a bit about winter.
It could be. Yes, it could be.
So, Mom, you want to introduce
Okay,
Judy?
Today we have an author. Her name is Judy Battalion, and she has written for the New York Times, the Washington Post, Salon, The Forward, and many other publications. She grew up in Montreal and worked as an art curator and comedian in London. She's had quite a varied life and now lives in New York with her husband and two daughters. And this book is a memoir called White Walls, a memoir about motherhood, daughterhood, and the mess in between. And we've all been there, I guess.
Welcome to Writer's Voices, Judy.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So let's start just from the beginning about, you know, why you wanted to write this book.
Why did I want to write this book? Great question. I suppose that the main themes of the book, which are the complicated mother-daughter relationship, the search for home, and our relationships to objects and spaces, are themes that I've been writing about for a long time. As you said, I was a comedian and an art historian, and so in those realms especially, I'd been addressing these issues. But a few years ago, I ended up writing a very personal essay about my mother's hoarding. And the piece sort of looked at how my mother's stuff left me with emotional baggage and issues I had felt with intimacy. I'd felt blocked from my mother by her piles of junk, and blocked from others as I entered adulthood. So I finally wrote that as an essay. It was very intimate, and that got some attention, and all of a sudden I started to see, oh, I think maybe there's finally a book here in this hoarding story.
Mm. Now, having read the book, I feel like I know you really well.
Yeah,
you
right.
You probably do.
Yeah.
You don't hold much back, or at least you don't appear to. If you're holding anything back, I'd really like to know what it is.
Right to the jugular. I certainly try to be quite open and honest in the writing. Obviously, I didn't include every scene. And I think as a memoirist who's writing about my family, I am always sort of confronted with the fact that I'm not just exposing myself, but people around me. So sometimes I hold things back if I feel that might hurt them as opposed to me.
Now, one of the things that I found most interesting, in the book, it's quite near the end when you actually write about writing that article.
Yes.
About your mother. And up until that point, tell us a little bit about your writing career up until that point, because you started out as an academic,
yes,
a curator for in a very sort of very specialized field. So let's start there.
Sure. So I've always been obsessed with the idea of home. I always was looking for this home to feel comfortable in. Growing up in a hoarded home, I never felt at ease. So I think I was emotionally and intellectually obsessed with this idea of home. So I began doing academic work, studying the meanings and concepts of home, and I ended up writing a PhD about domestic representations in contemporary art. And I worked at a museum of various design museums, and then in particular for a while at a museum of historical living rooms.
It just fascinates me that there's a whole museum dedicated to that.
Yeah, well, this was in England, and And first of all, the British are very good at quirky museums, and specific quirky museums. And there's a great interest in domestic culture in England too. So.
Really?
Yes.
So how do you find that in the States or in Canada at all? This interest in domestic culture, if you know where to look, can you find that?
I think so. I think some of the differences in American and British cultural ideas about home. In England, people have, in North America, I feel like people are very mobile and transient, and we move a lot. Whereas in England, I think there was some study I read that something like 90% of the population lives in a 5 to 10 mile radius of where they grew up. So I think home is a much more grounded place in the psyche.
Well, that's interesting. So you made the jump from that to being a stand-up comedian. That seems like a huge leap. What inspired that?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure it's for me, it was never that huge a leap, because I always felt that both academic inquiry and writing comedy came from a similar place. They're both endeavors of kind of observing and criticizing, standing outside of something and assessing it, really. In comedy, you're doing that in order to write a joke. In academia, you're doing that in order to write a thesis, perhaps. But they're kind of similar critical or distanced endeavors, which is quite different from writing more personal, emotional memoir material. So I always found those to be almost similar projects.
Well, in some ways, stand-up comedy, most stand-up comics use their own life experience, too, in their routine. So maybe the leap from there to memoir doesn't seem that huge to me.
Yes, of course. And so before writing a book of hundreds of pages, I had done a lot of first-person writing, both for the page and for the stage. And I'd been out there performing personal stories for a long time. So when you ask about being intimate, I have years of experience of being intimate in that way.
Well, it's interesting, too, to me that it seems like you you didn't share with hardly anyone the stories about your mother's hoarding for years and years. You were embarrassed to bring people home to your parents' home. So it's just interesting to me that you were able to go from that to sharing it on the written page.
Sure. I was very, very secretive about my mother's hoarding, about her mental illness, about my childhood home. For many years, it was very shameful to me. I had really projected it onto my body, onto myself, as being sort of messy and ugly, and something was wrong with it. And I think as a child, I internalized that. So for years into my adulthood, I was very secretive about this past, until I happened to be dating somebody who one day was taking me home to meet his parents and stopped the car and said, I just need to warn you, my mother has a lot of stuff. I almost didn't understand, because I certainly had not told him about my past. And what was he, did he somehow know? Or I was confused, and then we pulled up to this home with old Volvos in the driveway, and I thought, oh my goodness, get me out of here. But then it turned out that that this man, who later I happened to marry, spoiler alert, he reacted to his mother's collecting in a very different way. He gave me a tour of his mother's house, and he made jokes about it, and he hadn't taken it so personally. And I think I really learned from him that it's okay to distance from your mother's house. and to be able to laugh at it too.
Yeah, it seems like for you it was partially fear that you would end up being the same way, because your mother wasn't the first in her line to have this issue, correct?
My grandmother was also a hoarder.
Yeah. So I can understand why you would have that fear of being a hoarder, and also where your husband, because of the difference in gender, maybe didn't have that same fear to deal with.
Absolutely. I very much spent most of my life trying to not be my mother. So whereas my mother was, you know, very heated and emotional, I wanted to be cool and aloof. I, you know, moved to England, which was struck me as being sophisticated and far away. I worked in these galleries that were clean and pristine, and objects were treated as with beauty. They were precious. I kind of created a whole existence by doing the 180 from the family I came from, which didn't always work.
Mm. And that brings us to White Walls. When was the book published?
The book was published last Tuesday.
Whoa. So it's been out just over a week?
It's been out over a week. Yeah. I am in my postpartum
yeah.
right now.
Yeah.
And this is your first published book?
Yes, it is.
So how did you decide on this title?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. My dream of white walls that comes up again and again. I think the title worked for me on a few different levels. The book is very much, I believe, about intimacy and relationships, and explores how I try to make the right boundaries with my mother, with my daughter, with my husband, with people. So I was always interested. I always kept walls in mind as a kind of metaphor for something. They separate us, but they also bring us together. They're complex. They're dimensional. So I always knew I wanted to. I always had walls in my mind as I did it. And then white walls referred to the kind of galleries I worked in, especially in the late 90s, early 2000s. Everyone talks about the white walled gallery world. Mm. And they also refers to the mental hospital, which is, there are scenes in my book also set in mental wards. So It seemed to work on many levels.
So, Mom, as you were reading this, did you have any thoughts about, you know, your relationship with your mother and stuff?
Well, the thing was, my mother inherited a great deal of my father's parents' things. And they were historical. And so she kept them. Her stuff, I suppose. I don't think she had any more stuff than I do, but I don't know. I wouldn't say she was a hoarder.
No, we don't. Judy and our family, we have a tendency not. We don't go quite to the extent of hoarding, but we tend to refer to ourselves as pack rats.
Yeah, pack rats. Right, right. Yeah, yep.
So
that's a good description.
Yeah, we do sometimes have trouble throwing things away.
Most people do.
Yeah. Yeah, but you don't.
Well, in fact,
now the truth comes out.
I spent so many years kind of running away from stuff and trying to be clean, and I called it militant minimalism. then I had a daughter myself, and which is kind of the launch point of the narrative in the story. The white-walled life that I had so carefully constructed was much harder to uphold when you have children in your life. They are messy, emotionally and domestically. And not only do children bring a mess with them, my daughter now, she's in preschool and comes home with all these everyday amazing art projects of bejeweled pipe cleaners and toilet paper rolls and cards. And part of me is like, oh, garbage, garbage, garbage. But really, I actually have trouble throwing them out. You know, they're my daughter's creations, and
well, sure,
filled with sentimental value for me. And I started to understand a bit more. I'm certainly not a hoarder, but I did start to understand I developed a lot more empathy for my mother. And I began to understand perhaps that her objects, I had always seen them as distancing from me, creating these walls or barriers for me, but perhaps they were her way of connecting to me. They were her way of loving, too.
True. And your family history with the Holocaust and so forth probably had an impact on this, too.
Yes. My grandmother had escaped Warsaw with my grandfather, occupied Warsaw. They're Jewish. I'm Jewish. And my mother was born in 1945. On their return back to post-war Poland, they didn't know what they would find or who they would find alive. And my mother was literally born en route in Kyrgyzia. They had escaped to Siberia, my grandparents.
Wow.
And my mother was born, you know, in a makeshift hospital in the town of Jalalabad. And my grandmother always complained there was no one there except a janitor, and he didn't even help her. So it was, you know, my mother was born into so much loss and chaos,
mm-hmm.
and family trauma, that it's very understandable to me that she held on to things as a way to sort of create safety for herself and comfort. Understandable to me now.
Yeah, right.
When
absolutely. Yeah, because they lost everything.
Yeah.
Everything.
Yeah.
I think you hear stories about people who lived through the Depression who then, you know, couldn't throw away a piece of tinfoil.
Yeah.
You know, later on. And I still reuse my tinfoil.
Aha, see?
But only a couple times. And wrapping paper. We used to...
wrapping paper. Now we just... It's the bags. We just save the bags.
Yeah, we save the bags. But we used to... It was a big deal at our house. When we opened presents for Christmas, we took turns one at a time. It was a very long, drawn-out process. Everybody watched each person open each present, and it was a matter of pride to open the present without tearing the paper so that the paper could be reused.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
many of us enjoy, we keep things, we think they might be useful, we have sentimental attachments to them, we think they're beautiful, we haven't gotten to throwing them out yet, we enjoy shopping, but being a hoarder is actually, it's
a whole other thing, isn't it?
A whole other thing, it's a pathology there. You know, it's the number of these attachments to objects and the intensity of those attachments that differ. Getting rid of things would be, you know, truly traumatic for my mother.
There's one scene in the book where you tried to clean up the kitchen.
Yes.
And she made you take things out of the garbage.
Yes.
Oh, was that the tuna fish cans? Yeah.
Like, that's, you know, when I think they say when the hoarding gets in the way of people's functioning, of their safety, of their relationships with other people, that's when it's considered pathological. And yes, my mother, I mean, throwing her stuff out really caused, emotional breakdowns. She couldn't let go to a degree that it wouldn't. Most of us would not experience that.
Now, throughout this, your young adulthood, you were looking for ways to fix your mom.
Yes.
How do you feel about that now? Do you think, are you still trying?
I mean, a part of me will always be trying, I think. But as my mother gets older, and I suppose I've come to better understand her mental illnesses, and I don't try with the same degree of vigor, and I certainly feel less optimistic.
Mm. I mean, if she were willing to accept treatment, do you think there would be a possibility that she could get better?
Yes, actually, she is right now. Right now, she started to see somebody that comes to her house. I believe it's an occupational therapist who helps with her hoarding.
Oh, wow.
And that's quite a new thing. So I only recently found out about that. That made me actually feel very happy. There is some hope.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Judy Battalion, the author of White Walls, a memoir about motherhood, daughterhood, and the mess in between. And you know, it's funny, Judy, as I'm asking you these questions, I feel like I'm like being so personal, much more so than I would be, but it's because you did share so much about this in the book, and then I'm curious about, you know, about what's happened since the book was written and so forth. But let's talk a little bit more just about your writing process.
Sure.
So you said prior to this book you were writing articles, mostly essays, first person, personal essays?
Yeah, for a couple of years before the book, I had really dedicated myself to learning the craft of the first person essay. And I'd been really working on that and publishing a number of first-person essays.
And did you take classes, go to workshops, anything like that?
I took many classes, and I participated in many workshops.
Were you ever part of a writer's group?
Yes, and I still am.
How does your writer's group function?
So I've been part of many writer's groups, but I can talk to you a bit about one that I'm in right now. It's a group of people. They meet once a week. It's really spearheaded by one writer, and she organizes everything. It's always at her apartment, and she organizes it. We bring in work and we read it in session. It's a 2-hour session. And we read it there and critique it there. So, and it's a very quick-paced kind of group. So people only bring in a couple of pages of writing.
Mm. And how many people are in the group?
You know, there's usually, I would say, 8 to 10 people there.
And how often do you meet?
Once a week.
Once a week. And everybody gets critiqued every time?
No.
No.
No. Okay. There's a sort of limit of how many pages we can do. So kind of whoever says first that they have work to bring.
Now, are these all published writers?
It's a mix. There are a few people there that have written several books, and then there's often one or two total newbies too. So it's a quite unusual writing group in that way.
Sounds like a great group.
It does, yeah.
Now, Mom, you is your writing group still going on that you started?
Not at the moment, no.
She started a group at her church for mostly seniors.
Yeah.
And
what I called it was remembering ourselves. And at first I had quite a few people, and then, people moved away or, you know, in some cases died. And so then... or became ill and weren't able to come. And so right now, well, in the wintertime, it's hard.
Yeah.
Because it's hard to get out.
In Iowa.
In Iowa, yeah, in Iowa.
That is
right.
True.
For sure.
That is true.
You know, there's a great deal of interest in hoarding now in our culture because there's TV programs dedicated to it.
Really?
You know? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And they go into these people's homes and, you know, yeah. No,
oh,
no
wow.
kidding. No
have
kidding.
You
they
seen,
really do.
Have you seen that, Judy?
You know, the shows have been on for a few years. I actually find them hard to watch.
I bet.
Uh-huh.
It's too much for me. I did earlier on, I remember watching at the beginning, being like, wow, my house is like this. But I don't really watch them now.
Mm. Yeah, excuse me. Every now and then on the news you hear about somebody who, you know, where the police have gone in and, you know, where it's just
especially where animals
horrible.
were involved. Yeah.
Yeah.
The experts writing on hoarding now, academics and psychologists, they are estimating that 3-4% of the American population are pathological hoarders. And that's, wow, to me, a very high number.
I would say, yeah, that is. I wonder
about all the people that live with hoarders and who are affected by it. So that actually ends up being, to me, a surprisingly large percent of our population.
Well, yeah, and the people who are affected by it, let's talk a little bit about your, like, in your family. You know, Mom kept asking me about your, you know, we were wondering about your father and why he didn't do something.
Yes.
And you were wondering that for most
of
your...
That's a question a lot, and it's... Yeah. I always say my next book will be about my father. I think that I have a scene in the book where I finally go see a social worker, and she explains to me that sometimes when we live with mental illness for a long time, we almost take it on by osmosis. Our norm shifts, and we don't see it anymore. And I think a little bit that happened to my father. He got kind of absorbed into it, into the chaos as well.
And yet he was able to have a life outside or apart from that, a normal life.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Is that unusual, you know, that members of a family, well, you did, of course, you had a very interesting life, I would say.
Yeah.
But you,
so far.
Yeah, right. But you had left home when you started doing those things. Do you know, I don't know, I was going to say, do you know anybody who's in a home and not able to leave that tries to have a normal life, a job outside the home or something?
Well, your mother worked for quite a long time, didn't she?
She did work for a long time.
Yeah.
She stopped working, when I was a sort of late adolescent, or a bit early 20s, around there. I think working helped her a lot. It was helpful for her to have that structure outside the house.
You know, Judy, as I read your book, I feel like I, you know, got to know you and your husband and various boyfriends of the past and your relationship with your mother and your father very well. There was one character in the book who I think is probably very important in your life, but I didn't get a really clear picture of him, and that's your brother. Can you tell us a little bit more about Eli?
Sure. Yes, this was a big question when I was writing the book of how much of my brother to bring into it, and I must say I did leave him on the sidelines on purpose to some degree. I felt like my parents are almost fair game to write about. I say jokingly, but I felt like my brother is. I felt like it wasn't really my place to tell his story.
Mm-hmm.
He's young and has, you know, a life and a career ahead of him and has his own reactions to this. So I didn't want to tell his story for him or to implicate him too much in my story. But that was one of the challenges.
I bet, because I have a feeling that probably your brother was very important in your life. And yet we weren't able to really see that the important role that he played as fully as it might have been, but I can understand your reasons for doing it that way. Yeah.
But you know, a sibling gives you he was a partner.
Yeah.
He was someone to witness this too. I mean, even sometimes in the writing, I would call him and say, you know, I just want to make sure this happened, right? he was there. So no one else will know my parents in the way that he can.
Did you allow your family members to read this before publication?
I offered it to anyone who wanted to read it. And my husband read it and my mother read it.
And did they ask you to change anything?
So My husband, he's always the hero of the story, so he's fine with it. And he's read a lot of my writing over the years. He was okay with things. My mother, as you can imagine, I was extremely anxious to give her this manuscript, which talks, so much about her mental states and mental illnesses. And she's also been has periods of great depression and suicidal ideation, and which is also common with hoarding too. Mm. She had asked me to read it, so I decided to wait until I was in Montreal, where she lives, for a few weeks this summer, so I could be nearby in case there was any, emergency or. She had some, dramatic reaction. And so I did give it to her with much reluctance, and then I didn't hear from her for a couple of days, and I was extremely nervous. And then she called me, and she said, Judy, I read your book, and my heart stopped. She sounded so vulnerable and weak. And she said, I really think chapter 17, the humor didn't work for me there. Because, you're really not developing the narrator's sympathy in that. She had this, and then she was right as well. She had a very literary response to the work, which made me feel incredibly relieved and surprised and confused. But then I reminded myself we'd always connected through literature. Our relationship was always very fraught in person, but what really brought us together were, talks about TV shows and books and movies, and through my 20s we had this phone long distance relationship where we would really analyze my boyfriends through Sex and the City characters and stories and fictions were a really important part of what brought us together. And so here was another case where literature sort of was bringing us together, even though it was about her and written by me. But she, and since then, she's gone on to talk to me about certain chapters and explain to me her thoughts on why she behaved that way. And this week she's been reading the book over and over and really eager to talk to me. So, again, it's been a positive thing. And I've been so worried, but instead it seems to have helped us.
Wow. And has your father read it yet, do you think?
He just started reading it 2 days ago.
Wow. You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Judy Battalion, author of White Walls, a memoir about motherhood, daughterhood, and the mess in between.
I would imagine that your mother was very proud that you could write this, that you could write about her and yourself and your own daughter and so forth. And I would imagine that she didn't take it, she didn't get upset about it because she was proud of you.
Yes, I think she is very proud of me. My mother, she really loves me and encourages me. We've just had a lot of difficulties connecting, and she hasn't always been able to be there in a way that perhaps I needed. But she, at the base of it, she really is supportive and very loving. And I think my mother herself is, she had been a poet. She would love to write books. She would write amazing books if she could, but she can't. I think there's a part of her that feels pleased that I am able to do that.
When you were talking about when you were writing about things and asking your brother, did this really happen? I was wondering did you keep any journals, any diaries that you were able to refer to?
Not really, no.
Well,
no.
Do you now? Do you journal now?
I always have a journal going, but, the more I've been writing about myself, the less I feel goes into the journal.
Yeah, right.
A lot of it goes into my work.
Yeah,
so
sure.
I don't journal that often.
Well, Judy, before it gets too late, why don't you read from White Walls for us? And I know you told me you have a bit of a cold, so if it gets hard, you know, if you need to stop, that's fine. But.
All right. Well, I thought maybe I would just read from the beginning.
Perfect.
If that's okay.
Sure.
All right, so this is the prologue. Voyageur, New York City, 2010. It's time. My father's voice creaks through the phone. My father has called me exactly 3 times since I left home in 1996, and never at 8:30 in the morning. Her threats are serious. She's really planning it, he says. The details. He doesn't make any of his usual jokes. She is plotting her plot for when she plots is, or she's ready for her 72 virgins. That's how I know it really is time. I feel my esophagus battering through me like a pendulum. I'm coming. I dial my brother. Ellie, book us in at court for tomorrow morning, I say, as if I'm referring to a mani-pedi and not requesting an injunction against the woman who bore me. I hear my blood pump, quick, staccato. Imagine her gushing through her thick veins. Imagine it stop. She just likes the attention, I remind myself, attempt to console myself. 8 hours from New York to Montreal. I can make it. I must. I look out of my all-window apartment at the new high-rises and old water towers, at the buzzing Mondrian grid of Manhattan streets. I see their arrangement, parallels and perpendiculars, squares, equal angles. They are numbered in order, so no one ever gets lost. Someone is looking out for you. I live on the 18th floor, reminding me of high, the Hebrew for 1 and 8, the symbol for luck, the word for life. I am on top of things here on my mountain. I can see the moat, protect myself. What's going on? John, suited up for work, comes into the living room, which is sparse, airy, barely furnished, the exact opposite of both our mother's homes. I'm going to get the court order, I say, finally. Finally, he repeats, knowing that I've been trying to do this, waiting for my dad's support for years. I smell his Irish spring, like the Irish are so known for cleanliness, he's been known to joke in his British accent. To me, it's the scent of savior. Call me. If you're lucky, I grab his hand. He squeezes back. I memorize the pressure of his knuckles on my skin. Think how our body's link is entirely different from the hydrogen bonds that hold together DNA. I am wired. It's actually happening. I've only 25 minutes to catch the bus. Within 10, I'm packed and in a taxi headed to Port Authority Station. I call Mom as we stop and start in the traffic around Times Square. What's going on? My stomach is clenched. I can't go on. They're coming to get me, she says. She is terrified of them. There's no point. Even God is telling me to kill myself. Well, God's made a lot of mistakes, I say. But God? When has she ever once mentioned God? I try to breathe, feel the pulse in my eyes. 8 hours is a long time. I'm coming, I say, as we pass a billboard for yet another Shrek. Don't kill yourself. It's very simple, just don't kill yourself. The concept of her non-existence short-circuits my neurons. The area behind my forehead goes numb. I'll be there soon, I add, as the cab jerks to a halt. The need to check in with her became worse over the past few years. Sometimes she doesn't call back for hours. Usually she's just on Valium, or engaged in her fantasies, or deeply ensconced in masterpiece theater. Thanks, PBS, for your riveting programming that has aged me 10 years. I hop on the bus, clutching a Southwestern tuna wrap from Au Bon Pain. The difference in my two lives has never been more apparent. Within a quarter of an hour, I go from an aerial condo to Greyhound, sashimi to sandwich, my chosen family to my birth one, and accordingly, I revert. I find an empty seat. I know this route well. Voyageur is the Canadian branch of Greyhound. Meaning traveler, its rolling French connotes wild adventure, Jules Verne's exploration, sing-along expeditions across the Yukon's blazing horizon instead of the reality. The alcoholic luggage schlepper, the characters who travel back and forth with plastic bags instead of suitcases, and the racist customs officials who interrogate them. Seeing my Canadian passport, their main question is, did you buy anything? Well, I always want to answer, considering I've been away for 15 years, I have done a touch of light shopping. I text my friend Melissa, who I'm supposed to meet for lunch later that day, a mini celebration for my 33rd birthday. Heading to Montreal, I explain, just a little impromptu vacay. To prevent my mother from hanging herself with her vast collection of pencil cases, I don't say. I check in with Mom, still alive. I email my brother. You're on call when I lose reception in the Adirondacks. I'm thankful he's on the ground, can pacify her with his soft voice, his slow gestures, until I get there. He soothes her more than I do. She likes him better. Then I take out a pen and the forms that have been sitting in my drawer. I need to fill in the blanks and to do it perfectly. For years, I've tried to find ways to get my mother into treatment, secretly speaking to social workers, doctors, therapists, driven by the image of her cured, smiling, laughing like she used to, maybe even leaving her house, coming to mine. I've done more research for this project than for my PhD. Then again, my mother is much more complicated than representations of domestic space in contemporary art. You won't have a good chance at court unless your father participates, they all warned. He's the one who lives with her, enabled her, they meant. Only now, staring at the legal questionnaire and the patient's history, I'm not sure where to begin. How to narrate the tale of my mother falling apart, the brain that turned in on itself over decades, in little unremarkable steps, like the ascent of the Nazis, I think, and wonder if I should start with the Holocaust. My grandmother's escape from Warsaw to Siberian work camps, my mother's wartime birth in Kyrgyzia, in transit, her formative years in ravaged Poland, DP camps, born into the fresh smell of a murdered family, a refugee before she knew what home was, eventually coming to Canada, but never really settling, never committing to a house, a stable structure. The way a few extra piles of books turned into domestic hayhem, mounds of old paper towels, thousands of video cassettes, stale Danishes that formed a barricade across her kitchen, a fortress to protect from the next world war that was always just around the corner, especially in suburban Canada. The slow stewings of a victim complex, the disputes, the real estate battles, tens of thousands spent on lawyers, not to mention the rooms filled with spy devices used to record every meeting, the gradual disjoining from friends, cousins, siblings, her own name, the stacks of research to help her track down the people who are after her, who, she claims, break into the house, leave her cryptic messages, mess up her papers. The house bolted stiff with locks and alarms, loudly ticking clocks in every room, cameras, laptops, binders, the pill vials, the story of how a person becomes a shadow. I'm going to stop there.
Well, you know, and when you look at that, at your mother's background, it's really no wonder that she had difficulties. I mean, you know, to be born into that situation and oh gosh. Yeah, we don't realize, we have no idea. We really have no idea what some people have had to go through, do we?
That is true.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead, Judy.
No, I once read, I found this very interesting, and I can never find where I first read this, but that it takes four generations for these big traumas to pass through a family. And I have always been interested in that, and that's a little bit how I'm interested in questions of how these traumas have passed through us.
So I'm going to mention for people who just tuned in that you're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Judy Battalion, author of White Walls, a memoir about motherhood, daughterhood, and the mess in between. And this is published by Penguin. We always like to actually talk about how people found their publisher. So did you have an easy route to publication or a challenging one, Judy?
You know, there were ups and downs. I went through the traditional route. So I went and found an agent and sold it to the publisher.
And at what point in writing this did you look for an agent?
So this is important. I sold the book on proposal. So I didn't write the book first. Mm. I wrote parts of it. And I put together the sort of an overview of how it would work as a book, and I sold that.
Now that's pretty successful for a new writer. You know, that's a great coup for a new writer to be able to sell a book on proposal. What is it? Was it the fact that you had published a lot of articles? Do you think that made that possible?
Well, from what I understand, nonfiction, fiction, it would be impossible for a new writer to
write.
But nonfiction, there is more leeway. In fact, editors often, from what I understand, like receiving proposals because then they can help shape the book in a direction that they think will work best.
Yeah, I think that's true. Definitely with sort of more technical nonfiction. With memoir, I think you're kind of in between.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
But yes, the fact that I had writing experience, I'm sure it helped.
And how long did you spend writing this proposal? And then how long did it take from the time that was complete till you had a contract? And what did you do in between?
Oh, a lot of panicking. I worked on the proposal from September through sort of April or May, and I actually had a proposal teacher who I took a private class with her, and she taught me the basics of writing a proposal. So she helped me find the story and the way to present it. And then I approached agents, I guess in May or June. With my agent, I then rewrote the proposal because she had some different ideas about how we should present it to editors. And then it took her a few months to find the right editor for the project.
And how many agents did you approach?
I approached around somewhere like 12 to 15 agents.
And did you approach them by sending the proposal to them?
First I sent a query note.
Okay.
And some of the agents I was introduced to through other writer friends, and some of them was more of a cold email.
And the one that you ended up with, was it someone that you had been introduced to?
I'd been introduced to her colleague, and he really liked the proposal, but thought she would be a better agent for me. So, sort of.
And did you, was it hard for you to make the decision, yes, this is the person I want to have as my agent, or was it obvious?
I was lucky to have a few agents interested, and I found it a very difficult decision because you're signing up to something with sort of, it's like getting married without going on dates.
Yeah.
I don't know, you're obviously you can get divorced, but it's complicated. And then the other guys might not be around anymore. So
yeah.
I did feel pressure making that decision. But in the end I kind of just had to go with a gut feeling.
And it worked out so
yes,
far.
Worked out.
And so then you got the contract. How long did you have to get the book completed?
They gave me about 8-9 months to write a draft. And then I had about another probably 6 or 7 months of editing that draft.
Now, is this while you were pregnant with your second child?
I had a baby in the middle of all this.
So what was your writing routine? Did you have a writing routine, or was it just whenever you could fit time in between the kids?
Yes, it was whenever I could fit time in between the kids. When I was writing the draft originally, I only had one. I was pregnant, and I had one daughter at the time, and she had a fairly stable schedule by that point. So I was able to control my time a little bit more and predict my time a little bit more, which was very helpful. But having another baby on top of it has definitely been chaotic.
Yeah.
So how does this work? Does someone at the publisher edit the manuscript? Or?
Yes. I had an editor at Penguin.
Did you have any preliminary editors other than your writers group, perhaps?
I have a few friends and colleagues who I do share material with, and I don't think anyone read the whole manuscript, but I had different people read parts of it.
And how many drafts did you do?
Oh, God.
You know, it's funny. We get everywhere, you know, to that question, we get answers everywhere from, you know, well, basically I just do one draft, I edit as I go, to, oh, 20, 30.
Oh, yeah, I'm on the 20, 30. At least 10 significantly different drafts. So.
And how do you know when it was done, when it was good enough?
When the editor said, if you don't bring me those page proofs at PM, I'll kill you. It was literally that, you know, I have years to work on a project, and it's like 4:58, and I'm in a cab in traffic. How does it always come down to this? And I think because it's never really done.
Right. So. It could always be better. That was, you know, one of the things that as a kid I was drawn to math. I mean, I was good at writing and English. I love to read. I read all the time. But math was really my favorite subject. And the reason was when you did a math problem, you knew when you were done.
Yep.
You know, you had the solution. It worked. That was it. And with writing, you're never done. So do you have that feeling too? Judy? We seem to have lost her.
Change this.
Ah. What happened there? You were gone for a moment.
Never done.
Judy, are you still with us?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Now I can. For a minute there, we couldn't hear you.
Yeah.
So. Oh, I'm back.
Oh, good. Good. So, yeah, that feeling of really knowing that you're done is one of the reasons I love math and accounting, which I do.
Well, in this case, with your mother, now she's getting some help, so the story really isn't done yet, is it?
I mean, the thing about writing memoirs, the story's never done, as long as you keep living.
That's right.
You know, it's interesting now, I have two children, and that replicates my own childhood family dynamic more closely, and I feel I have a whole new pile of insights about my childhood family. I could rewrite the whole book with that extra year's knowledge. So
are you going to continue writing memoir, or are you moving into other areas like comedy?
I would really love to write something funny next. I actually am hoping to work on some humor things. But, you know, it's funny, as I say, I keep, now that I'm in this, I keep coming up with new insights and new ideas. So I thought once I wrote this book, I'd finally be rid of these themes, but I don't know.
I think they're going to follow you. And also, as you're, you know, like you said, you now have two children, and as your children grow, I mean, your relationship with your daughter is, you know, comes in at the end of the book, and even though she's very young, it still has quite an impact on you. And, now, at some point, I guess you have to be, you're going to have to stop and think about how your kids are going to feel as teenagers about what you've written about them as toddlers. Is that a concern at all?
Yeah, it is a concern. And it's funny because people always ask me, what does your mother think? And I'm always like, I'm also worried. What does my daughter think?
Yeah,
right.
Or will think. And, yeah. You know, in the book and in my writing, I've never written about her past the age of 3. And I need to, for myself, think about how to continue writing about her. I felt somehow up to the age of 3, your behavior perhaps isn't, you're not accountable for your behavior in the same way that an older child might be. So I kind of made an age cutoff for myself. But I'm not sure how it will work going forward. It is complicated.
It is. Yeah, and I think, you know, that's a good... Yeah, I don't think someone's going to be upset about what was written about them as an infant.
Right.
Or a small toddler, but there is a point where, Yeah, I know that my kids don't even like me. I'm always telling my grandson stories about his dad.
Oh, dear. Well, really,
and I sometimes get in trouble for that.
Right.
Did you ever tell him about the goat that thought it was a dog?
Oh, yeah, Hornswoggle.
Yeah, Hornswoggle, yeah.
We had a goat that chased cars and lay on the porch with the dogs, and that was... We have lots of stories like that. Of course, the ones that I remember, the ones about his dad getting in trouble, and of course, that's probably not what my son wants his son to hear.
Probably not.
Well, and that's another interesting point, that when we write memoir, when we remember the dramatic stories.
That is true.
We remember the turning point moments. We remember often, the times of heightened emotional experience. That's what
it's true. But then sometimes the truth...
Remember the everyday. We don't write about the banal 8 weeks between the episodes.
Exactly. Although sometimes that's where the real truth lies.
Yes, yes.
Is in the spaces in between. Well, Judy, we're about out of time. Are you working on your next book, or you're kind of just working on getting this one out into the world at this point?
I just gave birth.
Yep.
Busy nurturing this one.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, White Walls, a memoir about motherhood, daughterhood, and the mess in between by Judy Battalion. It's available wherever books are sold. You have a website. Do you want to give that?
Sure. It's www.judybattalion.com.
And thank you so much for being with us today, Judy.
Thank you so much for having me on the program.
And, Mom, do you have some final words of wisdom
yes,
for us?
Yes, I do. And we all have to remember this. If you had a bad day, don't worry. We all have a reset button. It's called tomorrow.
And stay tuned now if you're listening to us on Friday. Stay tuned for Planet Earthwild, where I believe we're going to be getting a tribute to the late, great David Bowie. And if you are listening on Monday morning, because this show is rebroadcast Monday morning at 8 a.m., and it will also be available at writersvoices.com, and would love to have you check out writersvoices.com. We just upgraded the site, and I'm getting all the content from the last 2 years up that we haven't had available online up until now. Or a lot of it was not available online. Some of it was available at KRUUFM.com. But I'm really excited about that, and I hope to see you all next week on Writers' Voices. Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com.